Much of our knowledge about ACORN, the community organizing group, comes from negative publicity. During the 2008 presidential election, candidate Barack Obama was forced to distance himself from the organization amid claims that ACORN had committed voter fraud. And then, in the summer of 2009, a couple of conservative activists with hidden cameras lured some ACORN staffers into giving advice on tax evasion and human smuggling. In his new book, Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group, John Atlas traces its history from welfare rights advocacy to the hidden camera incident that led to its dissolution this past April. The book is published by Vanderbilt University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings John Atlas to our show today. Hello.
Well, thank you for having me, Leonard.
Let's start by going back to the roots of this organization. Who's Wade Rathke?
Well, the story of ACORN begins with Wade Rathke in 1970. He grew up in New Orleans during the 50s and 60s, and it was a time in the South where there was widespread opposition to school integration. He dropped out of Williams College to pursue his dream. In many ways, this is what this book is about. It's about his quest, his dream, to build, to organize the poor into a national organization so that the poor could lift themselves out of poverty. And he went on to pursue that dream.
Well, even before college, he was having problems with authorities. He was suspended from high school for clashing with the administration.
Yeah, he was a smart boy, as you can tell, because he got into Williams College. Which is a very, very good school. But he always had trouble with authority. But one of the interesting characteristics of him, and maybe this is why he was able to pursue this dream for so long a period of time with much success, was he saw the world as good guys and bad guys. He was the good guy, the people who posed with the bad guys.
Where did this come from? His father worked for Chevron, and the family traveled a lot, didn't they?
Right. I think he was sort of rootless. And that part of him made him capable of being a community organizer.
And did it come when he read Saul Alinsky?
Well, he read Saul Alinsky. He read everything. I have to make sure you understand that. He read Saul Alinsky. He read books about labor organizing. He read books about the populists. So he read everything. He was very well read.
But where did this come from? He was criticized by people who grew up under meaner circumstances for being some middle-class white guy who really had no relationship with the kinds of things that he was supposedly trying to correct.
Yeah, I think he that was true with some people, but
Barbara Hampton, for example, a welfare African-American welfare leader.
Criticized him.
She said he's a middle-class white. He never had stomach cramps from hunger. How is he going to get the message over of the needs of poor people?
There were a few people throughout his career who he helped organize, were allies who might have said that, but very few. Most people understood him as a empathetic, truly committed person to helping to organize poor people help themselves.
One of his first welfare organizing projects was in Springfield, Massachusetts. That's after he dropped out of Williams?
Yes. After he dropped out of Williams, he wanted to fight against poverty. He joined the Welfare Rights Organization, which was an organization that organized welfare recipients, encouraging them to make more demands on the system. When he went to Springfield, that was his first organizing project of low-income people. There's many incidents, but there was one dramatic incident where he led welfare recipients to demand more clothing, and this turned into a virtual riot.
And backfired.
It backfired in the short run. But in the long run, he realized that the people he organized were supporting him, and they came back. And they kept organizing, and they kept winning victories. And he began to get this reputation as one of the best organizers for the Welfare Rights Organization.
But then he didn't stay in Massachusetts. his first major battle with a corporation was against the Arkansas Power and Light Company.
Yeah, which is very emblematic of Acorn itself. Acorn is about taking on powerful corporations who are, in this case, polluting energy company was going to build a giant energy plant that was going to spew out all sorts of pollution, and it was going to result in the destruction of nearby farms. And he organized, along with many of his new recruits, a campaign which resulted in stopping that energy company from putting up this plant.
Was it already under the title ACORN, Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now?
Yes. If what happened was, after he did the welfare rights organizing, he decided to pursue his dream of building this large organization. He was in Massachusetts. He got into his old Datsun, threw all his furniture in, and drove from Massachusetts down to Arkansas, where he created an organization which was first called the Arkansas Community Organization Now, and then later changed to a national ACORN.
Weren't the farmers threatened by the power plant middle class and supporters of segregation? We're not talking about poor people seeking welfare support as they were in Springfield.
Right. Well, when Rathke went to Arkansas, he decided that if he was truly going to help the poor, which was his primary motivation, it was going to be necessary for him to build an organization that include not only the welfare poor, but also the working poor and the middle class. So when a group of farmers were very upset about this plant that they thought was going to destroy their livelihood, they went to ACORN and asked if they could help. And they said, well, of course.
Yeah, this is going against the conventional wisdom. Most of the public interest groups during the 70s started in Washington, D.C., didn't they? Was he thinking very much grassroots here?
Yes. He thought that if poor people were going to make a difference, the key to that was the participation of the poor. So he wanted an organization where his members would help make decisions about the poor, about their what they were going to do, what kind of fights they were going to take on, march, demonstrate, and vote.
My guest is John Adams, who is John Atlas. I'm sorry. John Adams was the second president of the United States. John Atlas is a public interest lawyer. He also is a writer and an organizer, founder and current president of the National Housing Institute, and the author of Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organizing Group. It's published by Vanderbilt University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Was there a standard procedure that developed for ACORN's efforts? There was an article in the New York Times 2006, which describes how ACORN members in Gary, Indiana, protested a regional power company by paying their bills in pennies at a utility payment center. That's a very in-your-face, very direct way of protesting.
Yes. One of the
And witty, too.
Yes. One of the lessons by the way, I should say, you know, one of the ways they defeated the Arkansas Power and Light Company was they found that one of their largest stockholders was, guess who? Harvard University. So they had this organizing group in Arkansas, but they had recruited a number of students from Harvard who were now organizing with ACORN. They were able to go to Harvard University and put pressure on them to threaten Arkansas Power and Light that if they didn't close down that plant, they were going to withdraw their shares. So you can see what kind of tactics they involved themselves in.
Well, that's rather clever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's using their connections, their middle class and even higher class connections to gain what they want.
Right. And meanwhile, meanwhile, back in Arkansas, it was the farmers who were making all the noise and putting pressure on the local politicians. So it was this combination of grassroots people along with skilled professional staff that made them a success. And the incident you mentioned in Gary, Indiana, that's all about learning from Saul Alinsky, who said, be very unpredictable in your tactics.
And did they win there as well?
They won there as well.
You're right that Rathke in his early organizing made a point of recruiting blacks, Puerto Ricans, and whites simultaneously rather than going after one group in particular at any given time.
Well, again, if he thought if you're going to help the poor, that you should not have an organization just of the poor, that you needed also working poor of the very poor. You needed working poor, you need middle class allies, and anybody else who will come join your organization. So, and then, of course, it had to be not just black, but it had to be black, Hispanic, and white.
And people had to be paid, not asked to volunteer.
Right. So their organizers, he understood this was also a lesson from Saul Alinsky, that you had to have professional paid organizers working full time if you wanted to make a big difference, if you wanted to take on like a huge power plant.
Now, the things we're describing have nothing to do with what most people associate ACORN with, voter registration drives and tax advising. Were they a major part of the mission?
Well, not only did ACORN fight huge utility companies, but very typically, if you went into any one of its chapters, which at its peak were in 38 states, 100 cities, 700 neighborhoods, what would you find there? Well, you would find ACORN putting up stop signs at dangerous intersections, going into rundown parks where you saw broken glass and bottles and newspapers and cleaning it up and turning an eyesore into a usable asset. So they would stop foreclosures. And two of the things that they did was they had a very, very effective tax counseling program. So people could come in and learn how to – the best way to do tax returns. And they also had a home counseling program where they helped people become homeowners.
I mentioned the criticism of Barbara Hampton, the African-American welfare leader earlier. She also – she is not criticizing from the right – but she says that ACORN was interested more in power than in assisting the poor. How did Rathke respond to claims like that?
Most of the time, he just shrugged them off and went about his work in organizing the poor to help themselves.
Another thing that ACORN did in the early 90s was go after predatory mortgage lending practices. How did they get involved in protecting members from subprime loans before subprime loans even became an issue?
Well, this is one of the fascinating stories that I discovered when I was writing the book, because I started writing the book in 2004.
Did you start writing the book as an attempt to defend ACORN because it had come under such attack?
No. This was before – in fact, when I started writing the book and I would tell people I'm writing a book about ACORN, well, they would ask why, and I would tell them because I've heard – well, first, I've been involved in – as a legal aid lawyer – working with churches, environmental groups, trying to make a small difference. And then I had learned or I heard that this group ACORN was making a big difference. This was in 2004 in their communities, much bigger than most groups. So I thought, maybe I'll take a look at this this group, see if it's true, and then what we could learn from them. So that was my motivation for writing the book. But so I'm writing 2004, and I learn about this incident that happened in 1999, and ACORN takes on this battle against Household Finance Corporation. Now, you may be – you're the same generation as me, so you remember Household Finance. Never borrow money needlessly. Remember that ubiquitous song? Well, I used to think that they were a decent subprime lender, which was a legitimate organization. But it turned out in late 1990s, Household Finance turned from a legitimate – a subprime lender to a greedy, predatory subprime lender. And ACORN in its communities was getting complaint after complaint when they went door to door, as they do to recruit members. And they decided to take them on. And then ultimately, they were able to, and indeed, Household Finance was engaging in all sorts of predatory practices, which, you know, hidden interest rates, turning 8% fixed rate mortgages into 13% adjustable rate mortgages, and so on. And they were able to win a $500 million lawsuit and using that money to compensate people who were ripped off by HFC. And they warned the national political leaders at the time that subprime lending is a danger and it could cause a serious problem to America.
Did they get any response from people in government?
No. Most everybody ignored them. It was the era of greed is good, debt is better.
But hasn't Acorn also been accused of pressuring banks to lend to low-income buyers who couldn't afford their mortgages?
Yes, and that's true. Now, I always scratch my head when I hear people criticize Acorn for pressuring banks to do something to help poor people. We know that it's not unusual for example, Republican politicians and Democratic politicians to pressure large corporations to give them money for their support. So pressuring big, powerful people to do something in your own self-interest is American as apple pie.
But it's the same thing as asking for subprime mortgages, isn't it?
Well, that was the accusation. But in fact, what happened with Acorn's mortgages, they were able to negotiate with banks like Citibank and Chase and other big banks, very sound mortgage products that were affordable to its members. So these were not the kind of loans that were high interest. These were below market interest rates, and they had a record of almost zero default.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll find out why the roof fell in on Acorn. My guest is John Atlas. His book, Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group, published by Vanderbilt University Press. Stay with us. We're back with John Atlas talking about his book, Seeds of Change, the story of Acorn, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group, which is published by Vanderbilt University Press. Barack Obama distanced himself from Acorn during the 2008 presidential election following Senator John McCain's comment during a debate that Acorn was on the verge of perpetrating one of the greatest frauds in voter history. So how did Acorn respond to that charge?
Well, first, to understand that accusation, you have to go back several decades. Acorn had been under attack by the Republican Party for its voter registration for years.
They were saying that they were only registering people as Democrats?
They were disturbed, not that they couldn't say that because Acorn wasn't doing that. But what Acorn was doing was registering young people, black people, Hispanic people, people who tend to vote Democratic.
And was there anything wrong with that?
Aren't
there other groups out
there
registering people who would tend to vote Republican?
Yes. So there's really nothing wrong with that, except let me fast forward to 2000. The election is Bush versus Gore. Now, you remember that election. Gore won the popular vote. The Supreme Court appointed Bush to be president. But Karl Rove looked at the political landscape and he said, wow, this was a close race. He didn't use those words, but he said, this is a close race. If we're going to get Bush reelected, we're going to have to increase our voter turnout, but we're going to have to suppress the voter turnout of people who tend to vote Democrats. And when they discovered Acorn and realized that Acorn was doing a remarkable job of registering millions of voters. So, for example, the best way I can put it to give you a graphic example, in 2000, New Mexico went with Gore by 300 votes. So 2004 comes around. It's the summer of 2004, and the Republicans in New Mexico are looking around and they're saying, look at this organization, Acorn. They've already registered 35,000 voters. And they started complaining to the White House. And the White House ordered the U.S. attorney in New Mexico to indict Acorn for voter fraud. It turned out that the U.S. attorney said there was nothing to that. Of course, that also had to do with the Attorneygate scandal. You remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the U.S. attorney in New Mexico was fired for not indicting Acorn. But that gives you a sense of what the 2008 election was all about.
Because I'm sure that Acorn saw Barack Obama's candidacy as a real opportunity to achieve more dramatic goals. The people who they try to register in many cases were much more eager to register.
Yes. Yes, and that's true. And they
had Barack Obama signed on to this?
Well, Barack Obama had a long-term relationship with ACORN going back to 1995. He sought their support when he was – well, he was a community organizer in Chicago, so he knew the ACORN community organizers. He helped do a couple of trainings for them. He brought a lawsuit on their behalf to enforce voting rights laws. And when he ran for president, this is sort of interesting, he sought ACORN's endorsement, got ACORN's endorsement, and even hired one of their affiliated organizations to do a get-out-the-vote campaign for them. But then during that debate that you mentioned, when McCain accused Barack Obama of having this relationship, Obama immediately distanced himself, which was eventually going to really hurt them.
And it also – there was an accusation that ACORN was misusing federal funds.
That's true.
Wasn't there an investigation? The Government Accountability Office investigated that. What did they find?
Yeah, that's the government watchdog agency. They look over all the federal spending. They completely exonerated ACORN of misusing any federal funds or engaging in voter registration fraud.
But the accusation stuck.
Well, this is what happened. All the investigations about ACORN's alleged misdeeds, whether it was setting up a brothel, doing voter registration fraud, misusing federal funds, after ACORN was destroyed or just about when it was to go down, all these independent investigations came out exonerating ACORN of all these accusations, the most recent one being the General Accounting Office, which exonerated them from misusing federal funds.
Well, let's talk about that, the other case, the brothel case. There was the guerrilla journalist who did a sting. But you write, leading up to that sting, in the spring of 2009, Fox News ran 362 stories about ACORN.
Yes. So
What were they saying?
They were saying that these two guerrilla conservative activists entered ACORN's offices, one dressed up as a pimp, the other as a prostitute, and solicited advice from ACORN staff to set up a brothel. And everybody bought it. CNN bought it. The New York Times bought the story.
Well, they had videotape, and it did seem that that's what was happening.
Yes. The videotape was misleading, edited, and completely distorted the truth. It turned out that, first of all, the man who entered the office did not look like a pimp. He wasn't, a lot of people saw the videos of him looking like a Superfly pimp. He didn't wear that. He wore khakis and a dress shirt. Secondly,
they cut in the other images later.
That's right. Exactly. They edited in those images. Secondly, they went to 10 offices. In three of them, ACORN gave some bad advice. And I think it showed a weakness in ACORN's oversight and supervision. But in seven of the offices, the two people who pretended to be a pimp and a prostitute were asked to leave. In others, they were called the police after they left. And in one offices, one of the ACORN intake workers actually encouraged the prostitute to go to counseling. And she actually took her to a counseling service for people who are running away from their pimp who was endangering their lives.
Isn't it illegal to be videotaped without consent?
In two states, it is. In two states. But in several states, it's not. But at that point, the damage was done.
Well, it's a colorful story. And most of the media, in fact, I think pretty much all of the media, New York Times and everyone else, was fooled into misreporting the details about the clothing and other matters. Then later it came out, but it only came out that there may have been that the editing had occurred after O'Keefe was arrested for another guerrilla activity, backfired on him.
But to understand, you still have to wonder what I consider to be one of the most bizarre stories in modern political history. This is a case of when a truth is more interesting than fiction. That how did this still, the question still is, how did this organization, which was the most effective national organization with 400,000 dues-paying members in 38 states, lots of allies, how come they were still destroyed by the Republican Party? And a big part of the answer has to be laid at the footsteps of the mainstream media, because the mainstream media was the media that repeated the false accusations. The New York Times said it. Once the New York Times said it, then Democrats ran for the hills, their funders ran for the hills, and all their supporters got scared.
My guest is John Atlas, who's written a book called Seeds of Change, the story of ACORN, America's most controversial anti-poverty community organizing group. It is published by Vanderbilt University Press. Among the people running for the hills were backers like the Ford Foundation and the Annie E. Casey Foundation, because they didn't want to be associated with a group that was being accused of something so outrageous.
Exactly. In other words, in their eyes, they saw, well, the New York Times saying this is true. It must be true.
Well, couldn't ACORN have survived exclusively on membership dues?
Well, at one point they could have. But as it grew to this huge organization with 400,000 dues-paying members and a combined budget of $100 million and 1,000 staff, they had relied on foundations, liberal supporters, as well as actually partnerships that developed with banks like Citibank and other companies. So where at one point 80% of its funds were from dues, by 2008, I'd say maybe 20% was.
Wasn't it also reported in 2008 that Rathke's brother had stolen money from ACORN?
Yes, and that was that gave some credibility to the attacks on ACORN, because the founder, Wade Rathke, who was an organizing genius, as I think I show in the book, but in this case, he didn't report the embezzlement to his board and funders. And then when it came out—
To protect his brother.
To protect his brother. They did make an agreement to pay back the funds. He thought he was doing the right thing. I think it probably turned out that it was the wrong thing. But by 2008, when it came out in the New York Times, the damage was done.
And then there was also congressional funding, which was withdrawn.
Right, which to me, the defunding of ACORN by the United States Congress, it was a national disgrace. There is no other way to put it. I mean, here is an organization that may have had flaws, but what organization doesn't? But it was the most effective anti-poverty organization, and yet the United States Congress defunded them.
So they dissolved. But haven't some branches already reopened under different names?
Yes.
Like the New York Communities for Change?
Yes, yes. In 17 states, organizers and members, as well as its allies, are reforming in 17 states, and this is the good news. The good news is that people are using the old ACORN model, but they are tweaking it to make sure that they are less vulnerable to attack.
And they're also distancing themselves from the name ACORN.
Yes, they're rebranding.
Bertha Lewis, the last director of ACORN, says that the new ACORN can't be just the old family. So she is trying to reshape it as well?
Well, Bertha Lewis is actually not involved in any of the new organizations. Bertha is probably going to set up a leadership institute to train African Americans and Hispanics how to be leaders in their community.
Now, you have listed a lot of successes for ACORN. Some of them might anger some people on the political spectrum, but many of these things most people would find commendable. Why do you think ACORN found it so hard to defend itself? And why do you think so many of its the positive things it had done went underreported?
Well, first, it's a very difficult organization to explain. It is unique in American history. This is an organization that did community organizing and labor organizing. It had a home counseling service. It built housing. It had a housing construction office. It did voter registration, the most effective in the country. It did so many things, it's hard to get your arms around it. So part of the problem was explaining what it did. The second part was they really didn't have a good internal communications system. But maybe the most important reason why they were unable to defend themselves, I believe, is because in America, on the left, unlike on the right, you don't have a strong progressive movement that's independent of the Democratic Party. And what you really need in this country, if you're going to help the poor, is a more cohesive, progressive organization, a progressive movement that can defend organizations like this when they get into trouble. I'm talking about the environmentalists, the labor movement, progressive members of the Democratic Party.
But there doesn't seem to be any unified vision on the left. On the right, most people share certain basic beliefs.
Exactly, and I think that's a problem. There's not that kind of coherent underlying philosophy.
But isn't diversity a good thing?
Diversity is a good thing, but I think one of the problems on the left is that they're too often fighting with each other rather than doing the hard work of developing three or four core principles that would give energy to everybody.
What's happening to Wade Rathke these days? Where is he?
Wade Rathke continues to organize. In fact, he is successfully organizing internationally. He has organizing campaigns going on in Canada, Peru, and India, among other places.
But not in any of these successor organizations to ACORN?
I think that the people will begin, informally asking him for their help.
How did you get the material for this book? I'm assuming that somebody just opened up the ACORN archives for you.
Well, it was much more than that. This is what I would call an inside true story of ACORN, because I had a front seat at the last events of the last 5 years. I was the only journalist to attend their staff meetings, their board meetings. I had access to their internal email communications, any papers, all members of the staff. I hung around with the people so I could really get an inside idea about how they thought and what they did.
But they had no idea, of course, while this was going on, that they were going to wind up dissolving the organization somewhere down the line and giving you an ending to your book.
Right. It is a very dramatic story. Like I said, it's a bizarre story. It's in some ways unbelievable. I was hoping for a better ending because I really respected the work that the group did.
In the little time that we have left, about 30 seconds or so, was there anything that you came across that particularly surprised you, some story that you would have released to the newspapers if you knew that it would have helped?
The truth is that the whole thing surprised me. I'm surprised that there existed in America an organization so widespread with so many dues-paying members. I mean, at their peak, they had 400,000 members, that they were doing all these things all at once. That was the biggest surprise.
The book is called Seeds of Change, The Story of ACORN, America's Most Controversial Anti-Poverty Community Organization Group. It is published by Vanderbilt University Press. And I want to thank John Atlas, who is a public interest lawyer, a writer, and an organizer, for coming by today to talk to us about it.
Well, thanks so much for having me.